And one of the first research studies we did separately than this one was a few years ago. We worked with a college up in New York called Molloy, and we wanted to learn if we could just move one lever, and it was about small acts of kindness. So we actually did a 7-week study with them. The team, they got an email every Monday with lists of kind acts, very simple, small things. And they were challenged to pick one, if they could do one a week, up to 5, one a day, and they could decide. And that was remarkable because at the end of those 7 weeks, the anecdotal qualitative focus group feedback was unreal, what people said about more connection with their colleagues, more awareness of who they worked with, more willingness to want to help those that they were alongside of. And the only thing we changed was getting more of these micro acts to take place. We're all busy. We have the same amount of hours as the president and Beyonce, right? It's like, we all have 24 hours. So it's like how we're showing up and choosing our time. It's like, we are capable of what we're doing with it. So start small. Your act will make a difference and it will have a ripple effect.
This episode of the Kintsugi Podcast is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, which can help you bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. Hey there, my fellow like-hearted humans. It's Michael, and this is the Kintsugi Podcast. And we got a special one for you this week. It's one huge ripple of goodness. And I know you'll want to share this with everyone. At least everyone you know who's into kindness. And since you're a like-hearted human, I know you know a lot of people who are into kindness. This week, we have a beautiful story of connection here on the Kintsugi Podcast. It's with someone who is also like-hearted. Fancy that. She's curious. She's courageous. She's an innovator. And her jam is kindness. Imagine that. And her name is Jacqueline Lindsay. She's the founder of kindness.org. I so appreciate their take on kindness. Because let's be honest, when you hear be kind or kindness, most people would agree. It's good to be kind. Who could argue with that? Well, we can probably name a few, but we won't do that now. But 99.7% of people out there, when you talk to them about kindness, they're down for it. But in some circles, like, say, corporate America, kindness only seems to go so far. Sure. Companies can have the value of kindness. They can have t-shirts and posters that say, be kind. But privately, many leaders think it's rather soft. Because after all, we have a business to run. We can't afford to be kind, or our employees will go soft. They'll lose their urgency, their drive, their productivity. And all of that is rubbish. Because what Jacqueline and her team are doing is that they're putting scientific rigor behind kindness. Much like mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, they put scientific rigor behind the practice of mindfulness and meditation. So we go to the data. And the data shows that kindness wins. All the time. It's that beautiful ripple that can change companies, it can change communities, it can change households, and it can change the planet. What's remarkable when we slow down enough, I would say pause, breathe, reflect. In that space that we create, we can pour into it a whole bunch of kindness. That's why as part of our community, loving kindness or metta is a cornerstone practice. So I was so excited to be able to sit down and talk to Jacqueline. And I know you're going to love her too. So if you're ready, take a healthy breath in and a slow releasing breath out. Get comfortable and get to know Jacqueline Lindsay from kindness.org. Hey, Jacqueline, good to see you.
You as well, Michael. So happy to be here with you today.
Yeah, this is going to be a great conversation. This is a sweet spot because we get to spend the next however minutes talking about kindness. But before we get into it, I always love to start with this question. So as we sit down together, how is your central nervous system doing right now?
Right now, it is very calm. It is very relaxed. Yeah, I'm coming in grounded, coming off of a great weekend. Yeah, really excited to be here, very at peace and calm and collected. It's a great question.
That's good. I love the sense of like groundedness, and we share the same geographical space, like around New York, and it's a beautiful day to day here. So it just feels good. It feels grounded. So that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I do want to clarify, my spirit will always be in New York, but I did relocate at St. Petersburg, Florida. So I'm calling in from a very sunny day in St. Pete, but that's pretty standard for us here.
It usually is. So, but where your spirit may reside in New York, we are also having a very sunny day. But my hunch is probably with less humidity than you're experiencing down there in Florida.
Plus one that. Yeah, plus one.
All right. So we love a good connection story. My wife and I always love to talk to people about, hey, how'd you meet? So if Kintsugi is about connection, which it is, can you share how you and your partner, your husband, met?
Oh, yes, definitely. Let's get into that. So I was running a book club. It was 2006. And I had started a book club because I was new to faith and was trying to look at the intellectual side of it, and had put together a group on Friday nights to read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. And my husband was one of the 40 plus people attending this book club. And he would say, if he were here, that I ignored him for the first 3 months, but that he felt right when he saw me, he thought he would marry me one day. And it started as a very deep and meaningful and profound friendship that evolved over time. So yeah, but it started back on a Friday night in 2006 at a book club.
That is cool. I love that story. Oh, that's a great one. I always love these stories.
Yeah.
You know, this show will come out obviously in a few weeks, but tomorrow my wife and I celebrate 30 years of marriage. So.
Oh my goodness. That's so inspiring.
So it's really cool.
I love that. Yeah, we just had our 15 years.
Oh, congratulations.
So halfway through, what wisdom would you have for me?
Well, I would say give each other space to change and evolve. And, you know, because we're different people than we were 30 years ago. And I still love who she is, and she loves who I am, but we are different. So I think we've given each other grace to be able to do that. I think also for us, it was important to have separate interests. So we have like a Venn diagram. We have a lot of common interests, of course. You know, I have a couple of my things that I like to do for my own time to satisfy the introvert in me. And she has some of her things also to satisfy the introvert in her. So and then we have our stuff together. So now a lot of couples share everything and it works for them, which is really great. But I think everyone's formula or everyone's recipe is unique to the couple and to the relationship. But I would say allowing each other to change and evolve, have other interests so you can complement one another and talk things through. Like, so we find time, especially for active families or active couples, whether they be in a professional space right now or not. What we were finding, this goes back a number of years, with our kids, it was almost like as a couple, we were two ships passing in the night and everything was this transactional thing around our daughters. So we started carving out time, dedicated time throughout the week just to talk. That has now transformed into our dog walk. So every night we take a dog walk. And that's a chance for us to connect and talk about whatever happens to be going on in our lives together, but also just separately, things that we want to like, you know, get out, and it makes for a really good walk and talk kind of thing. So I would say those three things. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing. I love that.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. So if you could take your work to the side for a bit, we're going to get into your work. How would you describe who you are?
Oh, gosh. Curious citizen of this world, trying to wake up every day dedicated to figuring out how to be my best self in service of everyone else.
I love that. Yeah. The curiosity and creative elements of that. So I think that's a central theme of people that have come on to Kintsugi, just that curiosity piece. Like how can I be a better human to other humans? You know, bring people together. So that's awesome. I love that. We're going to talk about your work now with kindness.org. Before we go deep into it, I would love for you to just share how you would define kindness. Because right now it's out there in the public domain. It's having its moment, if you will. Hopefully it's a long moment. I think empathy had its moment through the pandemic. And now we come to kindness. And I would love for you to share how you might be defining it, or if you want to take it in this direction, how kindness.org defines it, if there's differences there.
Yeah, there definitely are. I think that's the power and bigness of kindness. It's so personal and intimate. And each person listening probably has their own definition and idea of it. And mine changes seasonally, day by day, depending what I'm going through. And in this moment, when I look out at our world, to me, I see kindness and would define it as courageous. So I think it takes something of us. And sometimes it can be really difficult to show up kindly. And so I've been noodling on that idea of the courageous side of kindness, and not necessarily heroic in the way we think of courageous. You know, it's sometimes the smallest things, but they take a lot from us. And so being aware and holding that tension. So that's where I'm at with it today. And organizationally, you're right. We did have to put some stakes in the ground over what we would define it as. So we had our own kind of baseline for impact. And we call it the ABCs of kindness. So it's an action intended to benefit, typically at a cost. So typically benefiting someone else, but it can be benefiting yourself when you're looking at self-care and self-kindness, and typically at a cost, because it does take your time, not necessarily money all the time, but it does take something of you.
Yeah, it definitely does. At minimum, energy, right? And
Exactly.
What I heard from you around the courageous part of kindness, your own personal definition, I think it takes courage not to be judgmental. I think the natural default, our reactive biology, is to judge what may be foreign to us or what we don't agree with. It's easy. Sometimes we're not even really all that thoughtful about it. And for us to pause long enough to say, I'm not going to go there, I think that takes some courage, because it's hard. And it comes from the heart, right? The origins of the word courageous, you know, and tying it back. So I love what you just shared. So how did you get here? The big question, like, why kindness? I was hoping we could go back a bit. And if you can walk us through, how did you get to kindness.org? And then we'll pull through some of the stuff that you guys are doing, you know, in my language, put a beautiful ripple into the world, and in the spirit of Kintsugi, really help us connect and heal so we can move forward together and really solve some of the world's problems that I think are worth solving.
Love that, Michael. How did I get to kindness? I think to your point, you know, what's going on internally that we might not even realize, the subconscious side of how we think and how we're operating and showing up. I didn't know just how desperate I was for kindness until many, many, many years after what I would say is my now why. So my why, quite simply, is that I've always wanted to live in a world where people are decent to each other. I credit my parents for instilling a very deep belief that we show up seeing every human as someone with a story, and we care well for them. We give them dignity and compassion and kindness. And I didn't ever really know much about the value of money, as it would equate to someone's success or identity. And they just really focused on character development. And so I knew at a young age, those were the things that were very important to me. So that would be more of the nurture side. And the nature side, I just felt wired to change the world. I really did always have big ambition and dreams of some points it was first woman president I thought I would be. And I just always wanted to be a helper since I was very little. And in my more formative years, middle school and high school, I didn't know at the time what was going on, but I started experiencing different forms of bullying. And I really saw it as a way that you just grew up. It was like, oh, this is normal. This is what it means to be in middle school. But I lacked the language to know what was going on. I lacked the tools to navigate what I was feeling, but it really affected me. It really started to chip away belief in myself. It affected my mental health. Words that, again, weren't very common 30 years ago. You weren't talking about mental health.
To your point, yeah, we didn't have this language. You know, when I went through middle school, and I have, a few years on you, just we didn't talk about this stuff. This was just, you know, kids being kids. And our parents were like, well, that's what happened when I grew up. Like, suck it up, you know, and just find a way to deal with it. And so we suffered silently. And we didn't really know how to handle it. But I'd love for you to continue.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. That I felt I was very resilient, and yet I was so affected by what was happening. And it was mostly kids just being mean. You know, there were some physical things, but it was largely about what I looked like. And I was poor growing up, but didn't realize, again, the value of what that meant for somehow my identity to people. And over time, I started to embrace these words I was hearing as my truth. I started to believe them about myself. And it really started to eat away at how I woke up every day. I started waking up depressed and sad and anxious and was really looking for things to make me feel better because I was so unhappy with who I was. And also you start to, I think everyone handles these kinds of things differently. For me, I started to take it out on other people. So it's like the bullied person becomes the bully, you know, yeah. In this way. And I then started finding ways to make myself feel better that just weren't true to who I was. And that led to a really difficult road with drugs and drinking. And between 10 and 20, my whole life took a nosedive. And I really feel lucky to be here today, standing with you today, because it was such a dark time. And it actually led to an overdose at 19. And no one thought I'd make it. I was in a very, very dark place. And those things, those wounds that I now carry, when I came out the other side and I did get clean and I did get sober and I found faith as an outlet to heal for myself and to find purpose for myself, all of that kept bringing me back to this singular idea of human kindness. I clung to it like a life raft, this idea of kindness, the kindness people showed me when I was healing, the kindness people showed me when I was getting clean, you know, and coming out of addiction. So many people were willing to show up and extend kindness to me in times when I felt like I didn't even deserve it. And then the unkindness, the thing I was experiencing and coming out of from other kids, I've summarized it now as kindness is humanity's greatest asset and unkindness is its greatest adversary. And so that's how I came to kindness.
So was it the overdose that was the wake up? Was that the aha to say, wow, like I got to change how I'm showing up for the world?
I think it was an important catalyst because my sister and her husband came to the hospital and asked if I would move in with them.
Oh, wow.
And they took me in a very, very, very compassionate and generous way. They really showed up every day to love me. And no, I didn't get clean after that. You know, I think it kind of was a wake up call, like, oh, you have a problem. But when you have a problem, that doesn't always, it's more about like awareness of it than necessarily being able to stop. I think that's one of the, you know, first things you realize with addiction. It's very hard to stop. And even knowing you have the problem is step one. It's a big step, but it doesn't necessarily.
It's a huge step. Yeah, just the awareness that there is a problem. And if you're constantly trying to numb the pain away, and my hunch is that you're also hanging out with other kids who are also trying to run away or hide from the pain that they carried.
Exactly.
You know, so you're in a group of people like, no, this is normal. This is just what we do. Like, We're the kids that have pain. We sometimes talk about it, but you know what we do in our time is we're going to try to find a way to make it go away, at least temporarily. You know, so your sister and her husband show up, and you talked about the people who were kind. I imagine you had people who showed up that you thought were going to show up for you. You had people that you thought were going to show up but didn't. And then you had people that you weren't expecting for them to show up, but really showed up in a big way.
Yeah, had all of that. Yeah.
It's those people like show up with, in our spirit of our conversation, with kindness or with love or support. Like they can make such a huge difference in helping us begin to heal, right? Because you can say, okay, there's a different pathway. And they're the type of people that, because recovery of anything is not linear. It's not a pretty chart on a LinkedIn post. It is messy. And you fall down a lot and you boomerang back to the beginning and you wonder if you have the strength to continue. What gave you the strength to continue? Obviously the people around you, but were there other things that you leaned on to help you heal and come back together?
Yes. I think what actually had me have a wake-up call is I had a faith experience where I feel like I met God, and I was a very strong atheist, so it was a very profound experience. And I didn't wake up and change everything after that, but I woke up with a commitment that I wanted to change, that I actually wanted to be better and to do better and to get back to the little girl that I had inside of me. And I stumbled a lot along the way, like we all do. And this happened about 20 years ago, this experience. And even, you know, with all of my learning and growing and evolving, I hung on to drinking as a last kind of standing vice in my life because it was, well, to be candid, in my mind, and this is what you convince yourself of, it was still legal.
Still legal and pretty normal.
And normal, yeah. Socially, I could get away with it.
Socially, like, everyone, hey, Jacqueline, have a glass of wine. What can I get you? You go to a party.
Exactly.
Yeah, but to your point, back then, totally legal, totally normal. It's like having a Coca-Cola or a Pepsi, glass of wine or a beer.
Yeah, I had stopped all my other choices of drugs at that time, which were really intense, obviously, and had let go of everything except that. And then finally actually got fully sober from drinking 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago. So,
wow, congratulations.
Thank you. So it's a journey. And I think that's what I started to realize, like, I had to cling to something bigger than myself so often and so many times because I was struggling and I was navigating the hardship of what I had gone through. I was navigating the hardship of how many people I had hurt along the way. I was trying to put a framework to all the choices I made. I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I was looking to numb the pain in all the wrong places. And so it was years of working through how to rewrite the narrative that I had about myself and what I said when I looked in the mirror. But I would definitely say faith has been a thread throughout. And even that journey has been somewhat precarious, but I'm on it. And going back to curiosity, I've tried to come at the whole thing with open hands that I don't know much. And so I'm just trying to be very humble and curious in all of it. And that's how I wake up each day.
That is beautiful. That whole concept of like, I don't know. I don't know. Like the ease that we can come into like not knowing in a world that seems to value knowing. Like we want certainty. What's the right answer for the test? What should we do in business? Like there's an over-indexing on like knowing what's right. And when we step away, maybe we have to take multiple steps away, a step back to like zoom out. And you think about this planet, all the different creatures on it, including us humans. Like there's so much that we don't know. Even our ecosystem of the mind and the body, like how does it all connect? And I sort of get an allergic reaction when I talk to people who, even in the contemplative practice world, from a meditative space or a gratitude space, and they seem so certain about so many things. And I'm like, I don't know if we should really go there because there's so much. Let's just take the brain, the mind as an example. There's so much to the mind that we don't know. We know more today than we did like 30 years ago when we were middle school or whatever, but we don't know. And getting comfortable with that, then allows you to be curious, to be like, hey, let's ask some really cool questions as I show up and you're on this journey. And in that space too, you can practice kindness. So you're on this journey and then you're like, okay, I want to go back to that little girl that, you know, I know that's within me. How did kindness.org come to life?
I had dabbled in so many things. I had been interested in theater and politics and international relations. And, you know, I just had dabbled. And when I got my life back on track around 20 years old at the time, it's when everything happened, I went and I sat with a guidance counselor at college. And I had a scholarship and had lost the scholarship. And, you know, I was just working through a lot to try to get back on track with things. We ended up landing on my passion to want to help and to serve. And I had always been interested in volunteering and had been volunteering for many years at that point in different capacities. And I ended up getting a degree in nonprofit management and communications. They had just introduced a minor at my school that was focused on nonprofit management. And now I think you can get like full master's in it. You know, it's totally different. And so I decided to get in the nonprofit sector. And first 10, 12 years were focused on fundraising and development. Not what I thought I would do, but I actually really loved helping people think about the power of generosity to solve big problems in the world. And that had led me to New York. I was at a job that I loved, you know, in a career that I felt thriving in and was learning so much and challenged intellectually. And it was a really humbling position. And I also was continuing to get back to this idea of kindness. And I was like, this is wild, but I feel like I need to take a leap of faith. And I thought all sorts of things. Maybe I'll do this. I explored a hospitality thing, ultimately decided to quit my job with nothing lined up and to just take some time to think and to be and to sit and to listen. And I landed on kindness. And a donor that I had been working with at the time, he also had been thinking about what he wanted to do next. And he had landed on kindness. And so it began this very serendipitous kind of exploration with what he's now my co-founder on what would we do if we were to build a kinder world? What would that look like if we were to focus on kindness? And fast forward, here we are. Kindness.org will have its 8-year anniversary this fall. So
that is so cool. Oh, what a great story. I do want to bring up an elephant in the room if I could.
Let's do it. Bring it up.
Because I think it's helpful and sort of the elephant in the rooms. I think maybe they only exist in corporate rooms. I don't know. Like, that's where I first heard, like, there's an elephant in the room. I'm like, and I was looking around when I was in my 20s, like, where? And they're like, Michael, it's a figure of speech. I'm like, okay. So we hear a lot about kindness. And I think a lot of people in business and corporations would categorize kindness in one of those soft skills, right? But I would add, they're the hardest ones to do. Like figuring out how to build a PowerPoint or an Excel workbook or whatever, that's relatively easy. One can learn how to do that. But skills like empathy and kindness and being mindful and thoughtful, they are considered maybe a little wooey. Mindfulness probably more so than any of those. And soft. And Jacqueline, we're right there with you. We believe in being kind. I grew up and my parents taught me how to be kind. And I think it's such a good thing. But, you know, we got a business to run. And I don't want to be too soft with my employees because we got goals and stakeholders and shareholders. And this is a, you know, a tough business. And we have to, like, our currency is honesty and respect and drive and all that jazz, right? You've heard this before, I'm certain. Or something similar. So we love kindness, but it doesn't have a place here because if we go soft with people and we're too kind, then all of this blows up and we can't deliver on our results. So I just said a whole bunch. What say you to what I just said?
Kindness is the best business tactic you can bet on.
All right.
And I've got the data to prove it. That's what I say. I love this so much. It is such an elephant in the room that we're going to let never be an elephant in the room again, at least for the people who hear this and listen and hopefully, you know, the megaphone I try to have out in the world on this. And just to help set this up well, one little preamble I'm going to add, that exactly is what kindness.org has set out to do, is to create a new narrative of kindness for people. So we rebrand kindness, and we do that by combining rigorous science, data, and evidence into applied solutions for real world impact. And this was a gap we saw 8-9 years ago. We didn't really see this combination of how you have the validated research, the research that validates why kindness matters, and then into things that were tangible for people. Specifically in the business world, I could just spout off so many interesting facts about the link between kindness and the bottom line, links between kindness, shareholder value, retention. I mean, there's so much out there. One of the most interesting things that we learned recently, we did a really profound piece of research with 6 companies where we tried to develop a new way to measure the kindness of a company and also to try to understand how important is kindness to your team members. Across all 6 companies, consistently. So a variety of sectors represented. We had tech, we had retail, we had higher ed. And across all 6 companies, all the employees cared more about how kind the culture was than what their income was, than what they were paid. So when you think about what kind of team you're creating, you can have both. You can have strong results, good bottom line, and a culture that's committed to caring well for your team that cultivates kindness. You can have it all, and it's a win-win. And frankly, I am so passionate that the future of work, there will be no place for unkindness. I just think it's the end of it for me is like, if you're not committing and prioritizing now as a company, you will be left in the dust.
All right. Let's take a break. Take a full breath in and a slow releasing breath out. And relax the body as you soak up our conversation. Ah, I hope that felt good. Okay, now that we're a little bit more relaxed, can we be real? I think our morning routines, well, they've gotten a little out of control. You might not have time in the morning to meditate because you're busy doing other things like trying to get to work or getting the kids off to school. And this is where my app, Pause, Breathe, Reflect, comes in because I built it for busy people with a whole bunch of shorter practices. So if you don't have 10 minutes in the morning to meditate, cool beans. You're human after all. But I bet you have 5 times throughout the day when you have 2 minutes to practice and let go of stress and bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. So today, download Pause, Breathe, Reflect for free and begin to stress less, sleep better, and join a community of like-hearted humans rippling something worth rippling into the world. All right, let's go back to our conversation and celebrate the Kintsugi within us all. 100% agree with you. I think we're living through an inflection point. Maybe coming off the pandemic, maybe the pandemic helped accelerate our thinking on this. It did give us time to, it was the ultimate pause, breathe, reflect moment because everything just shut down. But I do think employees, younger generation, maybe that hasn't laid down so many grooves or habits on how they think about work and their relationship with work, and companies are thinking about like, what's the future of work? How do we want to be together? Do we want to be together, right? You know, one moment we're all virtual, the next moment we're all coming back, the next moment we're hybrid. Like, so that's more about where do we gather or how do we gather? But then really, like, how do we want to be after going through so much? So I'm right there with you. I think it's a competitive advantage. I think it's a survival trait for companies too, to your point. If you don't have this, it's like, it's a gene that you don't have. Soon you'll be, you know, you'll be like, bye-bye, right? So those companies that you did the research with, those 6 companies, what were you measuring with those 6? Like, how did kindness show up? What was specifically happening in those companies that led to those results?
Yeah, so we were actually interested in trying to validate a new measurement tool that could measure the kindness of a company. So we introduced that tool, and that was based on action. And going back to our definition, there's the intangible side of kindness, right? Like you could think, oh, my neighbor is so kind. And there's like an essence or a being or an energetic vibe that someone gives off. And you're like, they're the kindest person I know. But again, going back for us and how we think about the work showing up, the way we look at kindness is the action side of it, because it's both and. You can be kind and you can act kindly. And so when we think about the workplace, it's really about the practices. It's really about the choices. It's about how is your leader treating you? How are you treating your subordinates? How are you treating your peers? And that's all done through the lens of what actions and behaviors are happening on a consistent basis in this environment that demonstrate kindness. And so that's the lens that we looked at it through. And then we did a lot around well-being. And then we asked standard questions around how valued they feel, how engaged they feel, and then temperature checks on what they felt mattered when it came to kindness. And so it was really free form. We collected a lot of open field texts on if your company could do anything to choose kindness, what would that look like? You know, what are the kindest things people have done for you? And it just was remarkable. It didn't matter, again, which sector people were in. The results were consistent.
That's interesting. So for leaders out there that may be listening, so I know a question that they might have is like, tell me more about the leaders of those companies. So they either came to you or you went to them to say, hey, I got this crazy idea. Let's measure kindness in your workplace because we have a theory that it's going to improve your workplace culture, which then trickle down effect or ripple effect, improve your bottom line. So what was it about those leaders from your perspective, Jacqueline, that made it easier for them to say yes to this study and yes to kindness? Was there anything in particular that you discovered that can be shared and maybe it's scalable to other companies or other leaders out there?
I love that. Yeah. So the research concept was something that was on our roadmap so that we could start to put data behind the value of kindness and paint the picture for businesses on why they should bet on it. So we had a partner come in who acted as the sponsor of it, our friends at Beekman 1802. We've been working with them for a long time.
Oh, yeah. They're great people.
They're wonderful. They're so kind, truly.
Yeah, they're so kind. Yeah. They actually have some of my kindness stuff too.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So yeah, a little bit like you guys have a little bit of it and they have some of it as well.
Nice.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that we had that shared connection.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear more about how you know them. They're like really walking the walk when it comes to kindness. And they have done a lot to bring kindness internally. So for them, it was, let us learn. We feel like it's making a difference on our side. Is it replicable, you know? And that's what we were interested in doing. So we jointly looked at a list of companies we would want to engage. We wanted diverse sectors represented. And I would say one of the key things that every company had and every leader had that said yes is they were willing to pioneer this, you know, to say yes to being a part of a research study that could illuminate things internally on your culture and what kindness looks like to your team. Maybe a little risky, but they all said, we're in. We want to help you study this. We want to show that we're committed to kindness as a company. We want to show that this research matters and is important. And so those were, I would say, consistently the qualities of all of these people as leaders and why they had their businesses and teams join us in this study.
So going back to that wonderful characteristic, they were curious,
yes.
Right? They were curious about what can kindness do for our companies. So with your business experience and my business experience, so we've been in a lot of initiatives like this. Mm-hmm. A consultant will come in from Acme Consulting Agency or a nonprofit like kindness.org and will put forth a new initiative. And you guys did the study, the results come out, kindness matters, full stop. But in my experience, the leaders, maybe the leaders in the middle. So you have like a CEO or a vice president that sponsors this research or sponsors this initiative. They've bought into it, right? They're drinking the Kool-Aid, if you will. But the leaders in the middle who have been working in such a way that may be kind, but may not be consistently kind, we'll use kindness as the theme here because of our conversation, they tend to struggle to develop new habits to really just be kind. Work and live with kindness in mind. So as we talked about before we hit record, it's not yet a way of living for them, although intellectually they want to be kind because the work stuff, the old ways of working get in the way. So can you share any of that? Did those companies also struggle in this particular area with the leaders in the middle really making this a consistent practice, just a way of living, or was it just easy peasy lemon squeezy for everyone?
Yeah, great question. We didn't study that specifically. So this research didn't speak to that. But I think what you're speaking to is one of the biggest things we hear from companies. How do we do it?
How do we do it? Yeah, consistently. Yeah.
Consistently. And what I and our team always go back to is start small. And it's really about the micro behaviors of how you're showing up as a team member and as a leader. And so this could be everything from starting off in the day, how you walk into the office or how you open up meetings. Are you diving straight into business? Are you acknowledging people? Are you looking them in the eyes? It's some of these really simple micro behaviors. And every act makes a difference. So we really try to remind people no act is wasted. And so every time you're doing it, you're having an impact on your team. And that starts to ripple out. They're then inspired to do a kind act for someone else. And one of the first research studies we did separately than this one was a few years ago. We worked with a college up in New York called Molloy. And we wanted to learn if we could just move one lever. And it was about small acts of kindness. Because to your point, we're all busy. It's really hard. How do you think about it? So it's like, how do you get that muscle built? So we actually did a 7-week study with them where every Monday, the team, all the employees that opted in, there were about 300 or so, they got an email every Monday with lists of kind acts, very simple, small things. And they were challenged to pick one, if they could do one a week, up to five, one a day. And they could decide, you know, how much they felt they could commit to. And it was a reminder. So they had that little nudge. And then it was just small choices they could implement. And the idea was, could they do it? And what happened if they did? And that was remarkable because at the end of those 7 weeks, and they were going through a tough time organizationally, the anecdotal qualitative focus group feedback was unreal what people said about more connection with their colleagues, more awareness of who they worked with, more willingness to want to help those that they were alongside of. Well-being went up significantly across everyone that participated in our surveys. And the only thing we changed was getting more of these micro acts to take place. And so I would just remind everyone that we're all busy. We all have the same amount of hours. We have the same amount of hours as the president and Beyonce, right? It's like, we all have 24 hours. So it's like how we're showing up and choosing our time. It's like, we are capable of what we're doing with it. So start small. Your act will make a difference and it will have a ripple effect.
I love that. And we might not have the staff of Beyonce or the president, but we can still do it. But to your point, going back to the college where I went to school, we had a really big thing about holding the door open for someone. And when I was there, I don't remember that we called it kindness, but it was we would hold the door open for someone for a long time. You know, like we'd travel around, we'd go to stores and work and places. And if you notice someone nearby, maybe a step or two away, you hold the door open. We would hold the door open for someone and keep it open if they were like 10, 20 feet away, because it was a way to say, hey, I see you. I see you. I care about you. Like, then the ripple effect, they do it for someone else. And going back to just how we start meetings, that was music to my ears because the companies I work with, what we're trying to do is help them start their meetings differently. Now, their meetings, some are live in person, but a lot of them are hybrid or virtual still. And people are running from meeting to meeting. So 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock, from one Microsoft Teams to the next. The first 10 minutes of the meeting, unless it's the first meeting of the day, you're rushing and still adjudicating the last meeting. And then the last 10 minutes of that meeting, you're thinking about, where do I have to be next? And you pop into these meetings and no one recognizes you. And it can be something so simple. You just spend a minute or two. Maybe there are 10 people on the call, maybe there are 30, and you go around the Microsoft Teams and you just say hi to everyone. Doesn't have to be a full-blown conversation, but just say, Jacqueline, good to see you. Glad you're here. Hey, Amanda, glad to see you. You know, and it's a way to say, from a culture perspective, I see you. I'm glad you're here. I appreciate that you are. And it can be such a simple thing to do that can be so kind. And that doesn't take a lot of time. It doesn't take a lot of cost either. to back to your ABCs. And if we just started doing that more consistently, I think we would change work cultures across the board.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, I'm very passionate about meeting culture.
Oh, yes. Well, because, hey, we're meeting a lot. And there are a ton of books, there are a ton of podcasts about meeting hygiene and meeting management and how we gather. And I think many of them are worthwhile and really meaningful. But I do think the reality is that companies are going to meet. And we might reduce the amount of meetings by 10, 15%, realistically. I don't think we're cutting meetings in half in the next decade. I just don't think that's realistic, just because of all the different things that are happening and the grooves that we've laid down. But I think we can do a significantly better job of how we meet. And it's just taking a few minutes, you know, it's sort of in essence, it's a pause, breathe, reflect moment before you drop in and to say, hey, how do we, it's asking that question, which is a question of curiosity. How do you want to show up for this meeting? How do you want to be in this meeting? How do you want to support yourself? How do you want to support each other? Because to your point, this is your time. This is your meeting. How do you want to participate in it? And so I think if we can get to that notion of how we want to meet or just emphasize that part of it more significantly, I think we can do a better job with just meetings in general. So I just came back over the weekend from my youngest daughter's college graduation. So we're now done with undergrad tuition in this household. So we're really excited. But inevitably around this time of year, as we sit here in the middle of May to record our conversation, there'll be commencement addresses that put a lot of weight into you're the future, the younger generation. You know, us Gen Xers, maybe some older baby boomers, maybe the millennials out there, we're old. You know, our habits have been developed, but you are the future, right? So we put, I think, too much emphasis on the graduating class to solve all the world problems. Hopefully, Gen Z can put pressure on the older generations because we all have to be in it to make it happen. So this is my long-winded way of asking you, Jacqueline, can you tell and share a little bit more about what kindness.org is doing in schools? Because if we can develop kinder schools, you know, in the spirit of a ripple effect, I think we can also start to move the needle in society in general. If the kids are treating each other with kindness and maybe there's more kindness at home, and if there's more kindness at home, the kindness comes to work and you see how it all goes, right? So how does your work look like in schools, like elementary school, in middle school, where you live through it, I live through it my own way. We go through so much developmental trauma. How can we be kinder to each other there?
Yeah, love, love, love that. Yeah, the first few years of the organization were really focused on more top of funnel awareness and action and conducting research. And so we churned out a lot of research, laid the foundation for who we were. And then years 4 to 7, we're really starting to build more deeper applied products and programming that could be introduced into different environments. And because of my experience, the first thing we bet on was education. So we started this work in 2019, which was understanding the kindness landscape within schools specifically, within kids specifically. And we decided, to your point, to meet kids where they spend the most time. So when we looked at both, oh, do we go through the home life and the parent route, or do we go through the education system? We did decide to focus on curriculum. And when we looked at the, you know, development of a child and their mind and their hardwiring and how they start to understand how they're showing up in the world, we're introducing a curriculum at the youngest age. So we started kindergarten. It does currently go through 8th grade. LearnKind, its name, was built in response to feedback from hundreds and hundreds of educators on the pain points they were experiencing with teaching kindness in the classroom. Kindness is nested under the umbrella of social emotional learning, and there were a lot of challenges that teachers were facing with bringing SEL into their classroom. Some of the barriers included cost. A lot of the programming out there was very prescriptive, so it would tell a child to be kind, but didn't really give them the tools they needed to navigate it. It didn't take lived experience into account. So a lot of teachers telling us, you know, my child hasn't heard the word kindness, or they're not experiencing kindness in the home life. So how do I teach them this? And they lacked flexibility. So we had a really tall order to think about how to design something that could not only overcome those challenges, but also have a measurable, tangible effect on the lives of kids. We launched it in 2020. wild ride, launching it in the middle of COVID, obviously. But our first year, we reached 38,000 students with our curriculum. And the way that we have flipped the script on teaching kindness is we have actually rooted the entire thing, you'll be so happy to hear this, in curiosity. And so it's called inquiry-based learning. And it's really about tapping into children's natural intrinsic curiosity. The students are scientists. And as far as we know, we think we're the only social emotional program that matches to national scientific standards. So it can be taught in science class. And the students are scientists and they go on a journey to discover kindness, to learn about it, to ask questions about it. They learn about mindfulness, emotional regulation, their own mental health and relationship with themselves. They learn about empathy and how to take all these things and extend it outward. And really what we're seeing, honestly, Michael, is an unbelievable change in student well-being, student connection, emotional behavioral challenges they might be facing, more kindness, more action taking place in the classroom. So that's our flagship program. We've reached now to date over 325,000 students around the country. We're active in all 50 states, and it's even being used globally, even though our audience is more domestic. So yeah, that is what we're doing to try to impact the next generation.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Yeah, that's so cool. Do you know of the work around Blue Zones?
Yes. Yeah, Dan Buettner. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dan's work. So when you were sharing that, Dan's work popped into my mind. In our community is a bedroom community to New York City. About 14,000 people live here. We have four elementary schools, one middle school, one high school. And as you drive through town, you'll see like we're an arbor town, like we plant a lot of trees. We're no stigma town. Like there's like road signs, and people are like, "What does that mean?" You know, I think about the town that I live in. If the schools were practicing kindness, it could have a blue zone effect. You know, I think Dan took his work around blue zones, his research, and went to a town either in Minnesota or Wisconsin that was naive to it. But they basically took all the blue zone characteristics and taught this small town all of them, like how to eat properly, how to have community, movement. We can go down the whole list. And they started to see differences in the town. And I feel all giddy for you. Like if we can have more kindness in schools and it's taught in science class, it can have a profound impact on just communities in general. Just it is in that spirit of a ripple effect to say, okay, like we're going to be known as a really kind town. And it's, you know, both and, right? So it's, we can be really kind and we're going to make some hard decisions as towns have to make when it comes to budget and investment and resources and all that jazz, because we can do both. And if we can get the kids practicing this, I do think it can have some good upward pressure on parents that we can change how we work together as well. And so we're sort of, it's a little bit of a push-pull or a bottom-up and a top-down type of approach. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's that ripple effect.
Yeah. It's, you know, to your point, as we've already mentioned, there's a cost to all this. It takes time to be kind. And this gets more to like some of my work in trying to help people slow down, hit pause. You don't have to stop. It's not stop, breathe, reflect. It's hit pause. We still want to do a lot of things. There are a lot of things that we need to get after and do. So we're just pausing for a bit to create some space. And that breath allows us to downregulate so we can have more spaciousness. And if we can slow down just enough, then there's room to be kind. There's time to be kind. You know, so that's why I so love what you all are doing, because it does parallel to like what we're trying to do here with PBR. It's just like we can slow down and have amazing businesses. And our kids can go to amazing schools, like all the different amazing that people are striving for. We can still have all that, but we can actually go a bit faster, but with greater quality or greater effectiveness when we just slow it down a tad. And certainly in that space, we can be more compassionate, more loving, and more kind. So yeah, I love that. What would you recommend for people to do? So if you would recommend like maybe 1 to 3 little micro practices. So people have heard this and like, yeah, you know what? I was on the fence around kindness, which come on, let's get on the other side of the fence with us, right? What would you recommend for people to do to start developing more of a way of living with kindness?
So if you want to dig deep, you can go to our Get Started page, which is full of resources for you to check out, depending what you resonate with, if it's the science of what we do, if it's the story of what we do, if it's the action. There's all sorts of ways that you can engage more deeply with kindness. However, if time is limited and you're like, I don't really know, I would start really, really small and remind yourself that everything, every kind act makes a difference. So everything you're willing to try to do to incorporate it into your day or week, it will matter. And so some of my favorite things that might feel low lift, but our research has actually shown are quite effective, is telling someone they matter. So if you are thinking of someone right now in this moment, text them. Just say, you really matter to me. If you really want to go the extra mile, tell them why they matter to you. Saying thank you to service people, you know, acknowledging what next time you're walking and you see the garbage person or the mail person or, you know, your barista, just really acknowledging them. Thank you so much for your kindness. Thank you for the work you do and how you show up. So just really acknowledging them. Saying good morning to neighbors. That's one of the things that neighbors have asked for, is just to feel that connection that you're, we're all so busy, everyone's rushing off, but what does it look like to just go and say good morning and acknowledge them and let them know you see them? And so those would be a few of the smallest ways that I would say you could try to do something to get out of your comfort zone maybe a little bit. And if you're all thinking, if you're listening, saying, oh, I do all those things already, amazing, I applaud you. Push yourself to do something bigger, something harder. Is there someone you need to forgive? Is there a note you need to write letting someone know why you're so grateful for them? Is there someone at work that you need to give credit to for something? So we can all push ourselves to go deeper and do the things that might take a little bit more of us as we cultivate the muscle of kindness.
I love that. I will add one of my favorites, hold the door open, if I could.
Love that one. Yeah.
And to your point of doing something harder, obviously we're sitting down in an election year. And I think a harder act of kindness is offering kindness to someone who doesn't see the world like you see the world. They might have different political views for whatever reason, but they're still human. They still want the best for their family and for themselves and their neighbors. And they just have different lived experiences that have shaped their perspective of the world. So we can start with that, like, human to human connection and offer them kindness. We do a practice at Pause, Breathe, Reflect called Loving Kindness, one of our meditations. It's a cornerstone. And we offer loving kindness to someone that just knows how to push our buttons. You know, they cause us stress or tension. And that is the hardest act. It's easy to, like, offer kindness to someone that, you know, we agree with, that sees the world the way we do. But it's that person that sees the world slightly different, that's causing tension, especially in this year. And we're still going to go through the act, the courageous act, as you mentioned up front, of offering them kindness as a way for us to come together and maybe have a conversation that is based in curiosity to say, hey, why do you think the way you think? And here's how I think, and this is what shaped me. So I love those tips. Is there something I should have asked you but didn't ask you?
No, but I think let's end on a high note to what you just said, which maybe we can put it in the show notes as well. But on that Get Started page on our website, so if you just go to kindness.org and go to the Get Started page, one of the articles that we've highlighted is a piece of research on the role of loving kindness meditation in reducing affective polarization. And so this was a really incredible research study that took Republicans and Democrats, and very specifically, it had three groups, and it was a control group with no meditation, a group that only did regular meditation, and then a group that did loving kindness toward the other political party. So it was specifically helping you have loving kindness towards someone on the other side of the aisle. And it was unbelievable what it did to reduce that affective polarization. And I just highly encourage people to think about it in that way as we head into, you're right, maybe what people are feeling is a difficult time with the election. So I love that.
Yeah, I will definitely include that in the show notes. And separately, I'll send you, I've done a couple of loving kindness election year meditations. So I'll send those to you. You can take a listen. So
cool. Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on. You just embody the Kintsugi spirit, as we talked about before we started. there's something called urishi. That's the glue. That's the lacquer that helps the pottery to come back together after it breaks. And then they dust it with gold, hence the name, the golden repair for kintsugi. And I do believe, I've long believed, that kindness for us is a way to heal. It's our urishi as humans. Kindness towards ourselves, because we didn't really get into it during our conversation, but we can be so harsh to ourselves, you know, with our own self-narrative. But as we think about breaking and cracking as a society, as people, we're searching for that urishi to help us come back together. You know, and again, we may not agree on every point, but we can find a way to get united. And I think kindness, actually, I know kindness is part of that glue. And I so appreciate you sharing it with the world through the work that you do. And I'm glad you're with us, you know, going through what you went through and now taking those really dark days and helping other people have brighter days is a really beautiful ripple that you're putting into the world. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me today. It was such an honor.
Yeah. Good to see you. Bye-bye. Yes. Kindness. I just love Jacqueline's story. She's gone through a lot, as she shared. And she found her way to her kintsugi through faith and through kindness and community. The urishi, that lacquer, that glue that helps our pottery come back together, is different for everyone. The key is becoming aware of what will do it for us. And then we dust that urishi with gold, and now we have these wonderful golden symbols of strength and resilience. And so often when we go through these trying times, these difficult moments, when we break, when we crack, with the right perspective, with the right mindset, we can use these moments as a way to heal, reconnect, show up in the world as kintsugi, and then ripple our gift forward. And that's what Jacqueline's doing with kindness.org, trying to spread the message, ripple the message, that kindness matters. And there's scientific data behind why it matters so much in the workplace and in schools and throughout our communities across this planet. So Jacqueline, thank you again for joining us here on the Kintsugi Podcast. Thank you for embodying the Kintsugi spirit and putting a massive ripple of kindness into the world and being a role model for others. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jacqueline and you took away a few pearls. And if you did, let me know what resonated with you. And since time is your most precious resource, I want to thank you for carving out some time to join us here in our space, here in our community, here on Kintsugi. I so appreciate you. And if you ever want to connect one-on-one, I'll drop my calendar link in the show notes and we can connect and talk about how we can put a bigger ripple of kindness into the world. Or anything else that you want to talk about. I also want to thank the great people, like-hearted, like yourself, at SaaSPod for making the Kintsugi Podcast possible. Thank you, folks. And I hope you'll check out Friday's Pause, Breathe, Reflect meditation. And if you haven't done so already, please download our app. It has so many wonderful shorter practices to help you weave mindfulness throughout your day. So you can bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. Plus, we do live practices throughout the week, including every Friday, we put a ripple of loving kindness into the world. It's a wonderful practice, and I hope you'll join us for one of the Fridays coming up. And between now and the next time we connect with each other, remember, if you have a challenging moment, slow down, come back to your breath, be kind to yourself, give yourself some grace, I know that you've got this, and here in this community, we've got you. And together, we'll put a beautiful ripple of kindness into the world. Thanks again for listening. I love that you did. And we'll catch you in a few days.